Well, good morning. Hey, we are so incredibly excited that you guys are here on Preview Sunday for At the Movies. If you're new around here, you are wondering what in the world is going on as we find ourselves in the middle of a politics series, that there are all of these movie posters around and there's props in the lobby, and next week there will be a picture booth that's up and running, and we're going to add some new things into the mix. But we wanted to give you guys a preview of what next weekend would look like, because we understand this, that you guys are a part of this and that your invite means something. But oftentimes, to get behind that invite, you have to see whether or not the church is going to deliver on what they promise. And so we wanted to give you a picture of what At the Movies is going to look like around here, and then we wanted to charge you with next week as an opportunity for you to invite people in your circle to be a part of this. But before we get to that, we have one last piece of business to get to. As we wrap up this series that we have been in over the course of the last 3 weeks called Talking Points, and the crowd goes wild, because this entire series has been about finding the perfect blend of politics and religion. And if you're anything like me, when you smash those two topics together, those two topics can be ridiculously uncomfortable topics to talk about, and topics that we can't wait to stop talking about them. And so the crowd goes wild, because today we finally get to stop talking about it. But here's what we believe with all of our heart. The reason why we do series like this is because we believe with all of our heart that the local church should be the safest place to have a dangerous conversation. And if you're anything like me, you know that these two topics, politics and religion, are maybe two of the most dangerous conversation points that we could find ourselves in. And yet we dive into this series figuring out what it looks like for us in our present world, with all of the political division that swirls around us, that we find on social media, that we find around the water cooler, that we find in the hallways of our schools, with all of the division, what does it look like for us to press forward and to approach politics and political platforms and political campaigns and political people in a healthy way in our world? And with that, we continue to press forward today. You see, around here, we don't talk about politics a whole lot. But for some of y'all, you get incredibly terrified about this topic because you grew up in a church that did talk about politics a lot. And what I'm willing to bet is that if you grew up in a church that talked about politics a lot, or you grew up in a family that talked about politics a lot, you typically discussed politics only from one side. Am I right? Like, your church or your family only approached politics from the right or from the left. That you rarely saw it from the other perspective or had discussions about the other point of view. And my hope is that throughout this series, that we have found ourselves not discussing politics from one side or the other, but finding ourselves acknowledging this reality. That no matter what side you fall on, whether you're on the right or you're on the left, every single one of us has work to do when it comes to this topic. Because the reality we have exposed throughout the first 2 weeks of this series is this. As we approach November, that one fateful Tuesday that is upon us, we all have but one question we must wrestle to the ground. And that question is not which side do you fall on, right or left. For those of us in this room who consider ourselves to be Christ followers, and if you're sitting there and you're like, man, I don't have a relationship with Jesus, I'm not sure I want to have one, there's good news. You simply get to judge the rest of us on how we are doing at this. But for those of you who are Christ followers, the one question that we must grapple with is this. Are you willing to put your faith filter ahead of your politics filter? Are you willing to put your faith filter and your relationship with Jesus Christ ahead of your political filter right now in our world and in our lives? Because if you consider yourself to be a Christ follower, no matter how difficult this may be, and trust me, right, you don't have to go any further than hopping onto social media for about 5 minutes to find that that is a difficult task to carry out, putting your political filter second or third or fourth or fifth or sixth in your life. No matter how difficult that may be, that is what we are called to do. And what's so incredible is this. Is that when we find a way to do that, to have our faith filter come first and our politics filter come at least second, here is what happens. The world and the culture around us begin to change. But if we choose not to do that, and we allow our political filter, much like the rest of the world, to come first and to drive our reactions, to drive our posts, if we allow that to stay in the first place, we do a disfavor to the rest of the world. We do a disfavor to the world when we allow our politics to engulf our relationship with Jesus Christ. You see, it's not a disfavor because we've completely lost our faith. It's a disfavor because we have allowed our politics to become the main thing. It's the thing that surrounds everything else. And our faith is still somewhere in there. The teachings of Jesus are still somewhere in there for us to pull out, you know, when they benefit us in that political argument or that political post on our social media. But it isn't the sum of who we are. It isn't that our faith comes first and we pick the politics out as we go. It's that our politics have found a way to come first, because that's how the rest of the world is functioning. Can't there be a better way than that? Can't there be a healthier way than that? Because oftentimes what we refuse to acknowledge in this argument, in this topic, is this reality. Jesus did not come to be a footnote in a political platform. Jesus did not come to be a footnote in your political beliefs. Jesus did not come to take sides. He came to take over. Jesus was the king who came to reset the order of things. To prove that in this life, in this world, in our culture, the greatest impact did not have to come from the top. That we could actually make a greater impact in our world by putting ourselves beneath other people. Yes, beneath Democrats. Yes, beneath Republicans. Yes, beneath libertarians and independents. Jesus was the king who came to reset the order of things. But when we edit and filter Jesus' word and what he wants for your life and for my life to fit a party platform, we rob the world of a message that changed the world once. Here's what's so incredible. We rob the world of a message that can change the world again. It's possible. It's what we are being called to as the local church, that we have been given a message that is capable of changing the world if we don't allow everything else that's going on in the world to water down and change that message in our lives. But in order to do that, we must not be party people. And I'm not talking about what Tag Team sings about. Party people, that's me, DC, and my man Steve Rowland. Nobody else grew up listening to Woomp, There It Is. All right? I'm not talking about the freshman year of college party people. I'm talking about God has not called us to be political party people. He has called us to be kingdom people first. And he has called us to be kingdom people who are willing to use the influence we have to then influence our parties. To be people who are big enough and mature enough in our current political landscape, in our current political environment, to look into our own parties and point out our own flaws. To look into our own hearts and point out our own flaws. Because there's a lot of that going on right now, right? Couldn't our political conversation use just a little bit more of that kind of maturity? See, almost 2,000 years ago, the world and the culture changed in a dramatic way. It was influenced both sides of the line. Both sides, when we look back through history, the Jewish temple religious system and the Roman Empire, both sides were influenced by this ragtag group of followers who were following a crucified rabbi. And the way in which that ragtag group of people influenced and changed the world and the culture around them was through this one crazy technique: culturally disruptive unity. I know those are big words, But we kicked off the series 2 weeks ago by addressing this calling that as the local church, as Christ followers, in our current political environment, this is what God is calling us to. This type of unity, becoming one as a group of people. Not being broken up by the circumstances of the world around us, but finding a way to not just become one, but to stay one in a way that nothing else ever has. You see, that's what happened 2,000 years ago. The local church was founded on the heels of this man named Jesus, and they found unity in such a way that no other organization had ever found. No other organization had ever modeled unity in such a way. Because the world in which they lived in, check this out, the Roman Empire, maybe you all know this from history class, the Roman Empire was founded on a very structured and separated class system. And what that meant is that you did not mingle with people who were outside of your class. For instance, if you were a group of people in today's day and age who made $100,000, you do not mingle with people who make $40,000 or less. Because in that day and age, associating with someone who is at a class level less than you always dropped your value. And so what you found was a society and an empire that was based upon the reality that I'm not going to give up my social standing for relationship. I'm not going to give up my social standing for the sake of somebody else, because it will be to the detriment of what I've built. It will be to the detriment of what has been passed down to me through my inheritance. And there is no way I am going there. And then this thing called the church and this man named Jesus walked onto the scene, and there was this group of people who began to live out something different. You see, you want to know what a culturally disruptive unity looks like? This is what the local church looked like 2,000 years ago. It was classes of people whose circles rarely overlapped, coming together voluntarily and regularly to worship the crucified God. These people were mingling with people who are symbolically below and beneath them. And that kind of unity, that kind of oneness, that was disturbing to the empire. So disturbing to the Roman Empire that the empire decided it needed to strike back. I'm just kidding. That was simply a shameless plug for Star Wars next week as we launch into At the Movies. So disturbing that the empire recognized that we must stamp this out, that we must get rid of these Christians and this thing called Christianity and this new movement that is sweeping across our empire. We must get rid of it and break this unity that they have found. Because this unity, if it is not stamped out, will break us. As the Roman Empire looked at this first group of Christians, you know the question that constantly came to their minds? How could they possibly survive what has been thrown at them? Like, we have stretched them from both sides. We have persecuted them. We allowed their own original religion to persecute them and have a say in crucifying this rabbi that they followed. The Jewish people have come out against them. And here we are as the Roman government kind of taking a back seat, but anytime we need to step in, we'll crush them as well. And we even put an emperor by the name of Nero in power who liked to take these Christians to his garden parties and strap them to trees and light them up as his candles that would light up his entire party. How could they survive everything that has been stacked against them? And what the Roman Empire missed was this, is the reason in which that unity survived and thrived was because this man named Jesus walked onto the scene and presented something new that was for everyone, right and left, top and bottom, that had the potential to change lives and change hearts, no matter who you were or what your past said about you. And that was irresistible. It was something that we see this guy named Paul, a guy that we've talked about a lot throughout this series. As he looks back over the life of this man named Jesus and the things that Jesus taught, he got this idea in a letter that he wrote to the church in Galatia. This idea to sum up everything that Jesus had taught and what the church was supposed to be about. And he did so in the third chapter. It's where we're going to pick up this morning. If you haven't done so already, that's a perfect opportunity for you to grab your weekly. It's what you got when you came in this morning. And if you crack that open, you'll find a notes page that we've designed for you in there. You can follow along as we move through the text. Everything will come up on the screen for you as well if that's not your style. You can also grab a pen from the seat back in front of you and take some notes as we go, some fill in the blanks that'll help you as you struggle with this over the weeks and the months to come as we approach Election Day. But as Paul is looking back at what Jesus taught and what the church was supposed to be about based upon what Jesus had taught, this was the conclusion that Paul came to. In Galatians chapter 3, verse 28, Paul writes this. He's talking about Jesus. He's talking about what the church is supposed to look like. And he says, there is no longer Jew or Gentile. And in that very first sentence, think back with me. As people in that first century were reading this letter, there already were these pings that were going off, these warning signals in their minds. You see, for every Jew who is reading this, you know the initial thoughts that went through their minds? Whoa, wait a second. We've always been the chosen people. We've always been the one who have had the right to the birthright that was given by God. We are supposed to be the ones who are in, and everybody else is supposed to be out. And now you're telling us that there is no longer Jew or Gentile, that we're supposed to associate with those who are dirty and who don't have the birthright and who weren't born into the Jewish culture that we were born into. This doesn't seem right. I don't know if this is cut out for me. And then on the other side of the line were the Gentiles. And you can just imagine for them, man, we've lived our entire lives under the premise that these Jews have thumbed their noses at us. And they've constantly looked at us as if we were dirty and we had no right to a relationship with God. And now you're telling us that we're supposed to become one with them, that we're supposed to love them, that there's not supposed to be a separation between us and them. How do we overcome what has happened for centuries? But Paul doesn't stop there. He says, not only is there no longer a separation between Jew and Gentile, there is now no longer a separation between slave and free. And it's like in this moment, Paul drops the hammer. Because in the ancient Roman Empire, the backbone of the Roman Empire was slavery. Slavery was proof to your success within the empire. So much so, it was such a constant part of the Roman Empire that every person within the empire was only one step away from becoming a slave. You see, in the ancient Roman Empire, here is how it worked. And oftentimes, we, in our present context, we think of slavery within our country as a race thing. In the ancient Roman Empire, it was not that. You see, in the ancient Roman Empire, it was based upon this. If you did not make your house payment, someone came for your house and your son. If you didn't make your horse payment, someone came for your horse and your daughter. If you didn't live up to your end of the bargain, someone within your household was becoming a slave to pay for the debt that you did not pay for. And as you can imagine, in a culture that is based upon that kind of living with slavery at the backbone and something needed to be offered for the debt in which you owed that you couldn't pay, guess which gender got pushed to the bottom over and over and over again? The female gender. Because in that day and age, they were looked at as the weaker gender. And as the weaker gender, they were the first to be offered as a slave. And Paul, in seeing that backbone and pointing out, there's no longer slave or free. There's no longer separation between slave and master or free man. But what you also must know is that this man named Jesus came to give dignity and worth and value and identity to everyone. And that means there's now no separation between male and female. That every single one of you in this new movement was elevated to a new level. Was given something that maybe you never had before. This thing that this guy named Jesus brought into this world was designed to be taken into the entirety of the world. Was made to be inclusive of every single person. As I thought about that, This daunting and emotional question came to my mind as I was preparing. How did we lose sight of that? How did I lose sight of that? You see, because there's this tendency in every single one of us to be the group that's in. But to be the group that's in, it must mean there has to be a group that's out. And somehow the church has lost sight of this unified mission that could only be fully carried out. You see, we can only, this is where I get passionate, this is where I get worked up. I have to apologize if you're not used to that. This is what we are being called to. The only way in which the church can fulfill its mission that God is giving us is if we recognize that we are being called to become one to reach the next lost one. We as the church are best when we become one going after the next lost one. But somehow we've slowly slipped back into this mentality that, well, I'm kind of only comfortable if we kind of have like the middle of the road sinners come here. Like, we don't want anybody that's too bad. Anybody that's made too many mistakes. Anybody that's had too checkered of a past. We're not so sure we want those people in here. Or I fall at this level, this class level within our present socioeconomic standing. I'm a middle class person. I don't really want too many lower class people walking through the doors. I don't want too many upper class people. Like rich people, poor people, they make me uncomfortable. And I don't need to be uncomfortable when I walk into the church. We take it to the level of, you know, that boss that gave me the bad review, that boss who isn't treating me quite right. Well, he goes to church there, and I'm not real comfortable with that, so I'm kind of out on this whole church thing now. That guy who broke up with my bestest girlfriend is now starting to go to church there, and I'm not so comfortable seeing him around, and so maybe it's just best if I just don't go to church at all. Where did we lose sight of what the church was supposed to be? Where did we allow lines to divide us and to lose sight of the fact that there's no longer Republican or Democrat, rich or poor, male or female, slave or free, Jew or Gentile, that this was made to be something that was for everyone? And when we make it anything less than that, that's not culturally disruptive, that's culturally adaptive. But Jesus introduced a new kind of church. And it was appalling to the empire. Because if something that appealing to the regular man caught on, then what the Roman Empire knew was this: the empire would unravel at its seams. And it did. Because as this man named Jesus introduced something new and he saw what was taking hold in the lives and the hearts of every man and woman around him, and he saw the future of the church. This is so incredible. In Luke chapter 16, this is what Jesus speaks of as he looks at the church and what it is to become. He says this: the law and the prophets were proclaimed until John. What's Jesus talking about here? You know, all those laws of the Old Testament, all 600 and some of those laws, those were good up until John came, but then I walked onto the scene. Since that time, the good news of the kingdom of God, me, Jesus, is being preached. And because of this love, love others, love others, love others, love others, that is being preached at all cost, guess what's happening? Everyone is forcing their way into it. People desperately want a piece of that. But that new message was scary to culture. It was different. It was threatening to their way of life, even if deep down they hated their way of life. And because of the change, they fought back with everything inside of them to throw off this thing called Christianity, to send them in a new direction. And they fought back hard. And we find that happening in one such instance. About 45 years after the death of this guy that we have just talked about, Paul, what we see happening is that a guy named Pliny the Younger becomes a governor of a province in the Roman Empire. And as a governor of a prominent province in the Roman Empire, one of your main duties was to carry out the edicts of the emperor. You were to carry out, right? Think of your job. One of your primary responsibilities is to carry out the wishes of your boss. As a governor, Pliny the Younger was to carry out the wishes of his boss, Emperor Trajan. And Emperor Trajan, in seeing this culturally shifting unity that was happening, this culturally disruptive unity that was taking place in the church and that was threatening to unravel everything within the Roman Empire, he came up with this one conclusion. What we must do is we must get rid of them. And he gives this edict to Pliny the Younger and all the rest of the governors within the empire that says, what you must do is this. You must seek out every Christian you can find, arrest them, torture them, and if they decide to recant on their faith, then they can go on with life and they can begin to worship the gods like the rest of us. You see, what Emperor Trajan believed was this. He believed the reason the kingdom was unraveling was because this one group of people, the Christians, wasn't worshiping the pagan gods like everybody else. And so if we get rid of them, maybe the empire will stop unraveling. And so I want you to find them, and if they will renounce their religion and they'll start worshiping the pagan gods, then they're good to go. You can release them back into society. But if they hang on to this thing called Christianity, you have permission to get rid of them. And so Pliny the Younger, as a wise leader should do, decides that before I carry out this edict, I want to do a little digging on my own. I haven't heard a whole lot about these Christians. I haven't seen them coming through the courts. I haven't had to sentence any of them to prison. But now I'm supposed to arrest them and kill them. I want to know what I'm up against. I want to know what is so wrong with all of these people. And so what does he do? He begins to arrest a few of them and torture them until they talk and explain to him exactly what's going on. And he sends out spies of his own to infiltrate Christian communities and to see what is at the bottom of all of this and what's the big hubbub from Emperor Trajan that he wants us to kill all of these people. And as he sends the spies out and they begin to return back, and as he's tortured the Christians enough that they begin to talk, he comes to this conclusion. And we find this conclusion, it's so incredible. We find this conclusion in a letter that he writes to Emperor Trajan. This letter has survived the antiquities for thousands of years. We have proof of the actual letter that Pliny the Younger wrote. And I want to share with you what he found about this group of people that they were trying to stamp out from the world. You see, Pliny the Younger wrote this in his letter. The sum and substance of their fault or error, because they must be at fault, there must be an error for us to go after them and try to kill them. The totality of why they are at fault or error had been that they are accustomed to meet on a fixed day before dawn. So the first thing that we can see wrong with these people are all of them from different classes are coming together and they are meeting one day of the week to worship this crucified God. And check this out. They were meeting at dawn. There was no such thing as a weekend in the ancient Roman Empire. And so they had chosen a day of the week, Sunday, for them to meet at dawn, to gather together and to worship and learn more about God. And they chose to do it before their workday began. At about 5:30 in the morning, they would gather together and they would do church together. And it got me thinking, like, if CORE announced, like, next week, y'all, we're going to Monday mornings at 5:30, how many of y'all going to be here? Yeah, all right. Maybe my hand should go down, too. But their first fault is they were so committed to this new way of doing life that they were choosing to gather together on a day before work, before dawn. And when they gathered together, this is what they were doing. They were singing responsively a hymn to Christ as to a God. These group of people, they were getting together and they were singing or chanting these hymns, these new songs that they had made up to reflect the love of their Father. Because at that time, there was no scripture reading because they didn't have scripture. They didn't have a book to read. They might have had pieces of parts that had been sort of passed down from letters that had been sent out to the church, but they didn't have what we had. And so to reflect on who God was and how much he loved them, they made up these songs. They made up these chants that they would recite about who God was and about what Jesus had taught. And they sang them together. And to bind themselves by oath. And you can just imagine, like, Trajan is reading this letter and he gets to this part and he's rubbing his hands together because, like, here's where it gets good. They're going to make an oath and it's going to be against the Roman Empire, right? Like, it's got to be to undermine us. They probably don't like us. And this is the sticking point. This is where we've got them. This is how we can arrest them and kill them. They make an oath. Not to some crime, but they make an oath not to commit fraud. Not to lie or cheat other people or businesses within our community. They make an oath not to commit theft. But they won't steal from one another. And every time they gather, they make an oath not to commit adultery. That they want to be faithful to their spouses and love their spouses more today than what they did yesterday. They make a commitment not to falsify their trust. That when they make a promise, that when they enter into a commitment or enter into a loan, that they are going to pay up on that loan and that they are going to live up to their commitment. And not to refuse to return a trust when called upon to do so. That when they are asked for help, when they are asked for something from someone, they want to be the first people that step to the forefront and serve and give to other people. And you can just imagine, like, Pliny, as he's writing this to Emperor Trajan, there's this smirk that comes across his face because he's like, no wonder I've never heard of these people. No wonder I have never experienced them in the court because these are some of the finest people in the kingdom. They don't cheat. They don't lie. They love their spouses. They live up to their word. There's a reason that I haven't had to arrest any of them yet or sentence any of them to death. Because these people are living out something that's radically different than the rest of the Roman world. Who are serving others and putting themselves beneath others and becoming committed to something so deeply that they're willing to give up of themselves and their time to do it. These are the very people in my kingdom who give dignity to every slave and every servant. That's just unheard of. These are the people in my kingdom who spent time with and loved people outside of their class. These are the people who, despite what had become customary within the Roman Empire to just abandon the sick because we feared death and we didn't want to get sick from them and die ourselves, these are the people who actually stepped to the forefront and began to give care to the sick because they didn't fear for their eternity. These are the people who, in light of infanticide, what we talked about last week, that if you didn't like your child because it was a little girl and you wanted to pass on to a little boy, or you didn't like your child because it had some sort of deformity physically or mentally, that you could just abandon them and allow the world to decide whether they survived or not and just leave them at the edge of the forest or at the edge of the river. These were the group of people who bucked that trend, and instead of leaving kids at the edge of the forest, they actually told stories about these people going to the edges of the forest and collecting the children and raising them, adopting them into their own family and caring for them as if they were their own. This is what the church once was. This is what we are being called to be as well. But what happened? What happened is this psychological tendency. I've taken you through history. Now let's go to psychology. What happened is this psychological tendency in every single one of us that has a tendency to creep up in our minds and our lives and our thought lives and the way in which we look at and react to other people in our world, especially those on the other side of the line from us. The thing that happened is this thing called fundamental attribution error. Anybody ever heard of that? Probably not. We don't talk about it a lot. A fundamental attribution error is simply this. It's our tendency as human beings to attribute what someone does with who they are. For example, when someone shows up late to your work, We automatically attribute what they've done to who they are, and we make this conclusion. They are late to work because they are lazy and irresponsible. Now, here is how we know this is a fundamental attribution error. Because we never do the same thing to ourselves, do we? Like, how many of us, when we show up late to work, we go home that night and we look in the mirror and we're like, Ben Carver, you know what the problem is? You are late to work because you are lazy and irresponsible. We don't do that, right? We're like, no, I was late because I got up in the morning and one of my kids spilled their breakfast all over themselves and I had to change their clothes. The other one lost their homework. And then we got to school at the same time as the rest of the city and the drop-off line was 2 miles long and I finally dropped the kids off and was headed to work and I hit a train. That's why I'm late. It's not because I'm lazy or irresponsible. It's because of the circumstances. And yet, in light of that reality, when we survey ourselves, we never give anybody else the same amount of grace. And this is where politics and religion convene. Because this has become the tendency when we look at the other side of the line politically. We give in again and again and again to the fundamental attribution error. And we begin to believe, oh, I saw that story about that one Democrat who was corrupt, so all Democrats must be corrupt. I've heard stories about the Republicans who are heartless. So all y'all who claim to be Republicans are heartless. Some of them, they lean really far to the left, and so all Democrats must be socialists. I've looked and I've seen some Republicans that are racist, and so all of y'all Republicans must be racist. And guess what? The political environment in which we live plays into that. Because they're okay with division in your life and in your world. They don't want to chance your vote on account of your relationships. They don't want to chance your vote on account of love. They don't want to chance your vote on account of you changing the world by how you respond and react to the rest of humanity. They want to create further division so that every time you look at the other side, you see what you shouldn't see so that you'll vote the way they want you to vote. Hello. Y'all okay? But isn't there a better way? Can't we just admit that mature, emotionally intelligent, empathetic people don't fall for that? Mature, emotionally intelligent, empathetic people, you know what they do? They decide to do whatever they can to experience walking a mile in that person's shoes before they pass judgment. They make a determination that before I determine who you are, I want to see what pains you're walking through. I want to experience your hurt. I want to know how you were raised. I want to understand your way of thinking. I want to see where you sit so that I can understand where you stand politically, so that I can understand where you stand passionately in this world. You see, it's the very reason that Paul gave us this charge to carry each other's burdens. Because until you carry their burdens, until you see who they really are, you will never be able to fully do relationship and love them well. You see, what Paul understood was this incredible truth. When you carry someone else's burdens, what divides us diminishes, and what unites us surfaces. When we carry each other's burdens, we become a people who fear less and understand more. This is how the church began. This is how the world changed. This is the instruction that was given. Carry each other's burdens, and in that way you fulfill the law of Christ. But one, love each other the way that I have loved you. So often it's easier to take the easy route. And the easy route says just pass judgment. Just judge them for what they are, what side of the line they fall on. Because judging others, you know what that does? The rest of the world is proving it to us. Judging others makes yourself look better and makes yourself feel elevated, right? And so if you just pass judgment to everybody else and diminish them, it will somehow elevate you. But that's not how it works. You see, when we do that, we're killing the character of the church. We're killing the life-changing message of Christ. We've been called to resist the rush to judgment and the fundamental attribution error for the sake of the kingdom. See, this is what Jesus instructs you and I to do right here, right now, in our current political landscape. Do not judge others, and you will not be judged. For you will be treated as you treat others. The standard you use in judging is the standard by which you will be judged. That passage points to but one question. When it comes to politics, the question that remains is this: what do you care about most? What do you care about most? For the next 2 months, do you care more about their eternities or more about their vote? Do you care more about the hurt that they have walked through in their past? Or do you care more about hurting them? Do you care more about showing them the love and the grace of Jesus Christ? Or do you care more about showing them the wrath and the judgment because of their political stance? What do you care about most? But Ben, how do we live this out? How do we prove that we care about more than just what's happening in the world around us? How do we model something that's different? How do we fight back from the rest of the world and the rest of the culture to change it in an incredible way, to introduce this something new that Jesus put onto the pages of history? How do we live that out? And this morning, I want to finish very quickly with these four steps that I believe with all of my heart. We as the local church are being called in the next few weeks, months, years, decades of our lives, and every piece of division and every political landscape and environment that we will face in our future, this is how we are being called to fight back. And it always starts with love. You and I are being called to love those on the other side, to love those on our own side, to listen, to learn, to have empathy, to see and understand where they sit. What does Paul write? Love is, what was the first thing that he said? Love is patient. How much patience are you showing? How much patience are you showing for the people on the other side of the line? We are being called to love in a patient way. We are being called to gather. You see, you can't have culturally disruptive unity unless you unify together and become one. We are being called to gather. Regardless of what is stacked against us, gather in large groups, gather in small groups, gather one-on-one in our lives. We are being called to become unified on mission together as one body going after the next lost one. We are being called to serve. To serve those who are beneath you, to serve those who believe differently than you, to serve those who are Republican, to serve those who are Democrat, to serve those who are libertarian and independent. We are being called to serve because how can the world understand your love if you don't serve them? And we are being called to keep serving when it's hard, when it's tiring, when it feels like there is no reward, when it feels like you have been at this day after day, week after week, month after month, to keep going because maybe your reward isn't for your life on this side of eternity. Maybe your reward is in their eternities that will be spent differently because you just keep serving and serving and serving and loving, even when there's no payback, even when it's hard, even when you're worn out, even when you're tired. What do you care about most? Do you care most about their eternities, or is it something else? And then we are being called, and I'm going to add another word in there, and you don't have to write it down because I didn't put it in your notes. We are being called to be irrationally generous. And this isn't just a financial thing. This is about being irrationally generous with our grace, being irrationally generous with our time. to give people the benefit of the doubt, to not allow this fundamental attribution error to take hold in our hearts and our minds, to not always associate what people do or what people believe with who they are, but to offer generosity through our love and our grace. And guess what? That's appalling to the world around us. But that is so appealing to every human who lives in the world we live in. This is what sets us apart. And the church's, your and I, response to politics was meant to be the same today as what it was 2,000 years ago. That movement was based upon something that was appalling to the Roman Empire, but appealing to everyone who lived within the Roman Empire. It erased lines. It opened doors to everyone. Why? Because the most important thing to them was the next lost person. Jesus made it clear, I have come to seek and save those who are lost. Now, will you as the church unify enough in spite of party lines to do the same? And when you do that, all you have to do is look back and see when they did that, this is what happened. I will build my church, and not even the gates of hell will overcome it. And when we do that, we will experience this as well. We are the church. Those were our people. We are being called to the same right here, right now, today, to live out this preposterous philosophy that the church was founded on. Love each other, love your enemies. But to do that, you must answer the question, what do you care about most? Would you pray with me? Father, this morning, God, we thank you for what a great God you are. God, we thank you that over the course of the last 3 weeks, while it's been uncomfortable, while it's been challenging, that God, you are calling us to something bigger. You are calling us to something better. You are calling us to set an example in our world, in our current political environment, of how we can do life differently. God, I pray this morning that we are a church, in light of everything that is going on around us, a church that sees we are only capable of carrying out our mission when we become a group, one group, going after the next lost one. God, I pray that we are people who are willing to love and gather and serve and be generous, to prove what matters most to us is you, your kingdom, not who wins on the first Tuesday in November. It's in your name that I pray. Amen.